From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up today on the show, we'll hear from science journalist Emily Anthes, author of the book Frankenstein's Cat, Genetic Engineering, Ethics, and Biotech's Brave New Beasts.
Scientists can now take a single cell from an animal's body and use the DNA it contains to build a brand new embryo, an identical twin of that animal. It's essentially like taking the entirety of the genetic instructions that gave rise to you and plopping them totally unchanged into a newborn baby.
That conversation, your summary of the day's top local headlines, and more just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. First up, though, these messages and access downtown. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later on the show, we'll feature an excerpt of a Natural History Museum of Utah lecture looking at the ethical implications of bioengineering and cloning. But first up, we have these headlines. Utah Senator Jim DeBacchus has announced that he is resigning as Democratic Party chair as of noon on Monday. The state senator cited health issues as the reason for stepping down. KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has the story, including reactions from all across Utah's political spectrum.
On Monday morning, the now former Utah Democratic Party chair, Jim DeBacchus, issued a statement explaining his decision to step down from the post. It was a statement peppered with humor, praise for his staff, and playful barbs for his political opponents. But as lighthearted as this resignation letter was, DeBacchus wrote that he would be battling some medical issues for the next few months, and the rigors of what he called a 24/7 war room job, that is, chairing the state's Democratic Party, were simply too much. However, the outspoken progressive will continue to serve as state senator and defend his seat this November. Here's Senator DeBacchus explaining his decision on Monday.
The Senate job is much more genteel and quiet and reasonable, and so he decided that I should perhaps give up the party chairmanship and concentrate on my public service in the Senate, and also work a little bit toward making sure my health is up to snuff.
Neither in his statement nor in his conversation with KCPW on Monday was DeBacchus explicit about his medical issues. But he did say the decision to resign came just a couple days after a revelation about his health.
It was really over the weekend. I got some medical news on Friday, and we just decided, you know, that there's a time and a place for things, and it has been a tremendously gratifying 3 years, and no doubt one of the great highlights of my life to be able to speak for Utah Democrats in Charlotte, at the convention, at the White House, but more importantly and more gratifyingly, all across the state of Utah.
When asked how his announcement was being received, DeBacchus retained the same sense of humor from his resignation statement.
A lot of cheering, a lot of it's about time, a lot of you're way overpaid, DeBacchus. So, no, really, it's been very gratifying. The response has been heartfelt and overwhelming, and I'm tremendously appreciative of the good wishes and support from so many people. It's been very, very, very gratifying.
In another statement, Utah Republican Party Chair James Evans said that he would miss debating DeBacchus, commenting that he brings, quote, uniqueness and high energy to their debates. Utah Republican and House Majority Whip Greg Hughes, a friend of DeBacchus, was surprised by the announcement. He credited DeBacchus for his hard work in leading the Democrats.
I think Jim has been a tireless advocate and strong leader for the Democrat Party here in the state of Utah. His job has been tough, and I think that he has upped the ante with how hard he's worked and really put Republicans on notice. He's been a worthy opponent on the battle for ideas.
DeBacchus says he'll be actively campaigning to win re-election in the Utah Senate, and he's considering starting a political action committee, or PAC, to help raise money for Democratic candidates in Utah. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
With a lead on name recognition and fundraising, former Saratoga Springs Mayor Mia Love is well-situated to lead the pack of eight candidates vying to replace longtime Democratic Congressman Jim Matheson. Love, who narrowly lost to Matheson in 2012, faces two GOP challengers this year. If she wins this November, she'd become the first Black female Republican elected to Congress. For Democrats, attorney Doug Owens brings a last name to the race that's familiar to Utah politics. He's a son of the late U.S. Representative Wayne Owens, a Democrat who represented Utah in Congress from 1973 to 1975, and again from 1987 to 93. Several Utah political observers say that at this point, Love's advantages in the Republican-leaning district means that the race is hers to lose. And finally today, Zion National Park officials say they found the body of a missing base jumper, marking the third death in 2 months by adventurers attempting to parachute off of Utah cliffs. Zion officials said in a news release Monday that the body was spotted by helicopter on Sunday afternoon. It's still unclear when the jumper went missing. The body has not yet been recovered from the remote area, and officials haven't identified the victim. Base jumping, which involves jumping with a parachute from buildings, bridges, and other towering features, is illegal in Zion National Park. In early February, 28-year-old Amber Bellows of Salt Lake City died in the park when her parachute failed to open. On Friday, 35-year-old Kevin Maroon of Moab died jumping from a cliff west of Moab in southeast Utah. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. And now on The Rundown, we're going to feature an excerpt from a lecture given at the Natural History Museum of Utah as part of their Pushing the Boundaries of Life lecture series. On Thursday, science journalist and author Emily Anthes discussed some of the ethical implications of bioengineering and cloning. Anthes' book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts, was published last year.
So all of these experiments, all of these possibilities would be great for human medicine. It's clearly good for us. But that doesn't mean that the work doesn't also raise ethical issues. The development of our new genetic tools has coincided with a growing concern for the rights and welfare of animals. Many people worry that genetic engineering causes pain and suffering in animals, and it certainly can. We can engineer animals now that suffer from all sorts of diseases, and some of these animals do not have pleasant lives. And when you start talking about something like xenotransplantation, we're essentially contemplating creating pigs purely so we can dismantle them. We can take their organs for ourselves. So that's one concern with genetic engineering, but it's not the only one. Even if you set aside all the questions about pain and suffering, there are issues, and we could ask whether it's fair to use animals to improve human well-being. Ethicists talk about this issue, and they say that animals have what's called a basic intrinsic value. That means that they're valuable simply because they're living creatures, and they're creatures with whom we share this earth, and that's enough. That's enough value for animals. And yet, when we use them for food or for fiber or for drugs, ethicists say we reduce them to what's called their instrumental value. That means we treat them as merely tools to be used or resources to be exploited for our own good. And one of the objections to genetic engineering is that it allows us to turn animals into even better tools. We can now, after all, give animals the very same traits we might like to exploit. And making animals more useful also makes them more likely to be used. In fact, genetically modified animals are beginning to take over scientific laboratories. The UK has been tracking the use of genetically modified animals since 1995, and you can see quite clearly in this graph, the red line at the bottom is the number of procedures or experiments involving genetically modified animals, and that's been on a steady rise since 1995, whereas there's been a small decline in the number of procedures involving genetically normal animals. 2012 was actually a landmark year when, for the first time, there were more experiments involving genetically modified animals than those that had not been modified. I would have loved to show you some statistics from the U.S., but our government doesn't actually break down this kind of data according to the genetic status of the animals. But this rise in genetically modified animals is actually driving an increase in the total number of lab animals being used. The number of scientific procedures involving lab animals had been on a decline since the 1970s, but it started to rise again around the year 2000, and that increase is attributable largely to the huge growth in the number of GM animals being created and used. Ethical considerations can play a huge role in public attitudes toward genetic engineering and biotechnology. One thing I learned in researching this book is that debates about biotechnology rarely come down just to the science. Instead, it's these ethical and moral values that often factor into our decisions. So just to give you one example of that, here's a question that a poll asked the American public in 2005. And the question was, which of the following statements comes closer to your point of view? Either government regulations should include ethical and moral considerations in addition to scientific evaluation of risks and benefits when making regulatory decisions about cloning or genetically modifying animals, or though ethical and moral considerations are important, government regulations should consider only scientific evaluation of risks and benefits when making regulatory decisions about cloning and genetically modifying animals. So essentially, the poll was asking whether lawmakers should take ethical factors into account when deciding on laws that govern this sort of research. The vast majority of respondents felt that the government should, in fact, take morals and ethics into account when making these decisions. Far more people than said that it should consider only scientific risks and benefits. Even in circumstances in which genetic engineering is ethically justified, and speaking personally, I do think there are plenty of those circumstances, that still doesn't release us entirely from our ethical obligations. We must continue to take animal discomfort seriously, to minimize their pain, for instance, by anesthetizing them when they undergo painful laboratory procedures. And we also have to meet not only their physical, but their psychological needs when they're living in the laboratory, as well as keeping the number of experimental animals as low as we possibly can while still trying to get at some significant results. So far, I've been giving examples of how engineering animals could be good for human health. But engineering animals could also be a boon to animal health. For instance, we can engineer animals specifically to be disease resistant. One of the most intriguing examples of this is that there are scientists in Scotland who are working on engineering chickens that don't get avian influenza. They haven't quite pulled that feat off yet, but what they did do in 2011 was they managed to create a chicken that doesn't spread the flu. So these individual chickens may still get sick, but they won't spread the disease to all the other birds in their flock. And the exciting thing about this kind of project is it represents a true win-win. It's good for birds, and it's also good for us. It reduces the threat to human health from things like bird flu, which has been a major concern in recent years. There's also procedures known as gene therapy, which is a method of treating certain genetic diseases. So genes code for proteins, and when there are mutations in genes, sometimes the body doesn't make the right protein or it doesn't make a functional version of the protein. This can cause disease, and sometimes you can reverse the disease simply by giving the patient a normal, unmutated version of the gene in question. The hope is that the gene will integrate itself in the patient's genome, and that the patient's cells will then start churning out suddenly a working version of the critical protein. It's still early days for gene therapy in humans, and there have been some setbacks, some notable setbacks, but there's been remarkable success for gene therapy in dogs. In one study, a man named Gustavo Aguirre, he's a veterinary ophthalmologist at the University of Pennsylvania, he treated dogs with a mutation in a gene known as RPE65. Normally, this gene codes for a protein that is critical to vision, but the dogs in this study all had mutations in this gene. They were unable to make the functional version of the protein, and as a result, all of these dogs had been blind since birth. This is Lancelot. He's one of these dogs. He had a mutation in his RPE65 gene, and he was blind at birth. But Aguirre and his colleagues set out to change that. To do so, they injected a functional version of the RPE65 gene directly into the dog's eyes. Some of the eye cells naturally took up this gene, and they started churning out a working version of the critical protein for the first time in these animals' lives. Within 2 weeks, the dog's vision began to improve. Within 4 months, they were able to successfully navigate a laboratory obstacle course. And what's especially remarkable about this kind of treatment is that it's permanent. So the first dog to receive it lived for another 11 years after the procedure, able to see until the day that he died. Thanks to gene therapy, dogs like Lancelot gained the gift of sight. And you'll notice in this photo, or you may have noticed already, that Lancelot is actually standing on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. And that's because after his successful gene therapy trial, his owners sort of turned him into an ambassador for gene therapy. And they took him to the Hill for some hearings on gene therapy and the future of these genetic technologies. So he got a little bit politically active. But the important point, I think, is that projects like these illustrate the potential of our new genetic technologies and the fact that genetic engineering doesn't necessarily have to cause animal suffering. There's a philosopher named Bernard Rolin who writes about this very issue, and I really like the way that he puts it. So if you'll let me, I'll quote him for just a moment. And he says, "It is simply false that all genetic engineering must harm animals, unless one assumes that all species of animals exist currently at their maximal possible state of happiness or well-being or welfare. Such a claim is not legitimate." So far I've been talking about genetic engineering, adding new genes to animals or changing their genetic code. Cloning often gets lumped into these discussions, but it's actually a distinct technology. So everyone here, I'm assuming, knows about the normal method of reproduction. A sperm cell carrying DNA from your father meets an egg cell carrying DNA from your mother. And when they meet, what results is essentially a biological cocktail. Half of your DNA comes from your mother, and half of your DNA comes from your father. Well, cloning takes these normal rules of reproduction and turns them on their head. Clones receive their entire genetic inheritance from just a single parent. Scientists can now take a single cell from an animal's body, a skin cell, a blood cell, another small piece of tissue, and use the DNA it contains to build a brand new embryo, an identical twin of that animal. It's essentially like taking the entirety of the genetic instructions that gave rise to you and plopping them totally unchanged into a newborn baby. So a clone is essentially an identical twin born years after its genetic double. In the process of reporting my book, I had the chance to meet the world's first cat clone. And she was created by scientists out at Texas A&M University. Their cloned cat project began in the year 2000 when the scientists there partnered with a billionaire to launch a commercial pet cloning company. They wanted to give pet owners the opportunity to clone a beloved pet, maybe a pet that was going to die or had died, to sort of bring the pet's genetics back. The only hitch, and this was, of course, a big hitch, is when they launched, nobody had cloned cats or dogs yet. So they weren't sure it would work, and the first few years of the company were devoted to testing the technology. For the first project, they set out to clone a cat named Rainbow, a calico cat. Now, we throw the word cloning around a lot, and we see it in headlines and news stories, but one of the things that I found as I reported this book is we almost never talk about what it actually means or how it works. So I'm going to spend a few minutes talking you through the process of how these scientists went out to make a copy of Rainbow. It starts with the animal you want to clone, in this case Rainbow, and by harvesting some of that animal's cells. Now, you might have Rainbow's skin cells, which have her entire genome inside them, but you can't just take a skin cell from a cat and put it in the uterus of another cat and expect a brand new cat to grow. That's not how reproduction works. So in order to get a clone, you have to somehow get Rainbow's DNA and the DNA from that skin cell into the proper vehicle, which is, in this case, an egg. So the scientists needed egg donors. They did what they call recruiting female cats to be egg donors, but I assume that's somewhat euphemistic because I don't think the cats had much choice in the matter. But they had these female egg donors, and they harvested unfertilized eggs from these cats. Then they sucked the nucleus out of each one of these eggs. You may remember from your biology classes that almost all of our DNA, the vast majority of it, sits in the nucleus. So when you suck the nucleus out, you're removing all the genetic material that is already present in that egg. Then you take one of Rainbow's skin cells, or whatever cell you're using, and you inject it, the entire cell, into the empty egg. And you inject it just between two different membranes, sort of the inner and the outer membrane of the cell, and the smaller cell just sits there in the egg. Then you shock the whole system with an electric current. The electric current basically turns all of the cell membranes into Swiss cheese. It pokes holes in the cell membranes. And what happens in that case is the DNA that's in Rainbow's skin cell flows into the empty egg. The egg sees this sudden influx of genetic material coming in, and it is basically tricked. The egg thinks it's been fertilized by a sperm, and so it suddenly begins to grow and divide just as it would normally do in that situation. That gives you a cloned embryo, a young early embryo that happens to have all of the genetic material from Rainbow. You then transfer these embryos into more cat volunteers, and these cats act as surrogate mothers. You hope that some of them implant properly, and you wait out the pregnancies, let them develop, and if all goes well, several months later, you'll end up with a kitten, a clone that is a genetic copy of Rainbow and is not at all related to the surrogate mother that carried her.
And again, that's an excerpt of a lecture given by science journalist and author Emily Anthes at the Natural History Museum of Utah late last week. You can find a full podcast of this lecture and all of our past programs at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks once more for tuning into The Rundown here on KCPW. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tune in each weekday at 5 for an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.